Hey now, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Deadhead Cannabis Show. I'm Larry Mishkin of Mishkin Law in Chicago. We have a great show today. We're going to be featuring a recently released New Riders of the Purple Sage live album called Hempstedder from the band's performance at the Calderon Concert Hall in Hempstead, New York on June 25th, 1976. So we're just shy of 48 years ago. And our guest today is Rob Bleetstein, who many folks know is the host of the three live concerts that get played every day on the SiriusXM Grateful Dead station. He's also the voice of Pearl Jam Radio. And most importantly for today's episode, the archivist for the New Riders of the Purple Sage and the producer of the Hempstedder album that we will be featuring. Dan, let's dive right into our first number so everybody knows what we're talking about.
With some great music from Marin County, California, the New Riders of the Purple Sage.
So that is Panama Red, the New Riders of the Purple Sage, an American country rock band that emerged from the psychedelic rock scene in San Francisco in 69, and its original lineup included several members of the Grateful Dead. Panama Red is a well-known jam grass scene music song, but it's perhaps not as widely known that Peter Rowan wrote the song. Peter Rowan, a member of New Riders, and I could go on to talk about this all day, but why bother?
Peter Rowan was not a member of the New Riders.
So right away, this is why I shouldn't be doing any talking really very much today. We're going to bring in Rob Bleetstein, who's our guest. Rob, thank you so much for joining us.
Good to be here again. Deadheads Cannabis. Hey, what do you know?
Well, we're very excited to have you, and thank you for taking the time. Let's dive right in. Let's talk about New Riders. I want to know about this album. You're the producer. I got a bunch of questions, but tell us all about it.
It finds the band at the later stage of their sort of heavy touring years. They had just left Columbia Records the year before after making seven albums for them. And they made one. They signed to MCA. They made this new record. They were touring, and while the records may have, you know, lost their spark of original material in the later years, the live shows still, you know, around 1976 and 77 were just on fire, especially in their hotbed, the East Coast tri-state area and Long Island, especially. So this night was a rather hot one. I was there.
Oh wow!
I was in the front row. I was in the front row.
Even better.
It was the last day of ninth grade, and it was.
Was it the first time you ever saw them?
No, it was. First time I saw them was 1974 at CW Post College.
Wow. Okay.
I was like a month before my 13th birthday.
Of course, these were the same parents that let you take a bus down to see the Grateful Dead with a bunch of high school students. So you're doing okay.
Yeah, that's just how it rolled.
Right. I love that.
Thankfully. Thanks, Mom. So, yeah, so this night was, they played two nights at the Calderon Concert Hall. The Rowan brothers opened the show, by the way, both nights. And also this concert was broadcast. So it was recorded, the show happened on June 25th of 1976, and it was broadcast on July 4th of 1976. by WLIR, so I had been living with this, you know. This could very well possibly be, you know, one of the most listened tapes I've ever encountered in my life. So I'm hearing it a lot for a long time. And then finally came across, an actual soundboard from the band's vault of it. That's not the complete show. It's missing the last two songs from the encore, but got you all that we could. And there's more on it than was on the broadcast.
Well, and I appreciate, you sending it over so we can listen to it. I listened to the entire thing, and I was on the verge of writing you back to say, maybe there's a few other songs. And I thought, no. I'm going to let this guy call the songs on this one. This is his baby. But every single tune on there is just wonderful. The production is great, and they sound like they're playing right in your living room.
Yeah, they're on fire. I got to point out that Buddy Cage on pedal steel guitar is just, it's just flying the whole night. And David Nelson sounds great. He's singing a lot of songs on this one. Does a lot of cool covers Hard to Handle, Dead Flowers, Flowers. Never Can Tell. A lot of song that Deadheads will be familiar with.
And Buddy Cage, he played the pedal steel. He kind of followed after Jerry decided to go just do his thing with the Dead.
Yeah, they were. I think they and Jerry sort of handpicked him. You know, they had known about him. They played with him, and there's a picture of Jerry and him playing together in the train car in Festival Express. Because Buddy was on that plane with Ian Tyson and Great Speckled Bird. Buddy was just a master, and so great. And there's, in terms of the songs on this album, there's plenty of John Dawson classics, and I really have to point out the version of Portland Woman, which is like a 12-minute really jammed out thing. And the Riders weren't known for being a jam band, but on this tune they did. I guess it was my first Mirrorball experience at that show. The Mirrorball was going during it, and they get pretty out there. It's pretty good.
That's pretty wild. Now, this is off of their album, The Adventures of Panama Red. So this was already, their fourth album out?
Yeah. It's the title track of Panama Red, which was their first gold album. Came out in October 1973.
Okay.
And, the last studio album that featured the bassist Dave Torbert.
And my big research on this said that one of the songs, Kick in the Head, is actually a Robert Hunter tune.
It sure is.
Okay.
I know the story went something like, he was writing all these songs for the Dead, like, well, where's one for the Riders? And I think that one wound up, but Hunter performed it on his own for a long time too. But yeah, that's a great one.
With Donna Jean and Buffy St. Marie singing background vocals, I saw also. That's fun.
Yeah, they contribute to, I think, the John Dawson song, You Should Have Seen Me Running, and a few others too. And yeah, there's horns on this record. This was produced by the Nashville producer Norbert Putnam, who's actually a Muscle Shoals guy, but was in Nashville at the time. So he's sort of legendary. And it was, I know it was a meeting of like two different minds too, because previously the Riders had done everything at Hyde Street in San Francisco with Steve Barnhart, and I guess they did something different on this one. You know, it's a different, I guess they're looking to, expand their sound, expand their horizons, and that they did. And then they expanded everyone else's horizons with that cover of Panama Red.
Okay. Now, at this time, how many of these guys in the band are original members?
On the Calderon?
Yeah.
John, I'd say two and a half. you got John Dawson and David Nelson are originals, and Buddy Cage is as close to original as gay. Like, he replaced Garcia, but he'd been there since November of 1971. So I count, and as the years progressed and the bass players kept changing, and then a drummer change, I consider Buddy as close to an original as you'll get.
Okay. And one question that's always kind of been on my mind, how did Dawson get the nickname Marmaduke?
Have you heard of a Shub Capo, that on a guitar? The thing that guys put on a guitar to change the key on a different fret? Rick Shub was the person who was involved in that whole Palo Alto, Menlo Park scene in their earliest days. And Marmaduke was living in a house, I think, even with Hunter, maybe with Dawson, with Nelson too, Rick Shubb lived there too, and I guess the story goes they were smoking a great amount of Acapulco Gold one night, and Rick Shubb just walked in and said, "You're Marmaduke. You're more of a." He said, "You look more like a Marmaduke than a John Collins Dawson the IV." So there's that. And then Rick Shubb went on to create that capo, which is one of the most popular and well-known capos out there.
Okay, that's very cool. It had nothing to do with the silly Marmaduke dog cartoon that I used to see in the paper when I was a kid.
Now I wonder who came first.
Right, even better. that's a good question. Something we would have to dive into and see. Excellent, very good.
So yeah, and I'll say the album is available on Omnivore Recordings.
Oh yeah,
it's available only on digital and CD right now. You can get that CD at the NRPS store too. Just go to nrps.net, hit the store button, and go right to it, or anywhere else you consume your music. And everyone always is asking about LP vinyls and or LP vinyl, because I can't understand the word vinyls. that's in the not-too-distant future. That's all I can say about that. I can't give you a date, but I can tell you it's coming.
That's wonderful, too. Let's dive back in really fast and take check out another track. This one's called 15 Days Under the Hood.
Well, I'm trying to get this accelerator cable free. 15 days under the hood. Andy Granatelli's on the radio for STP. 15 days under the hood. Man, I'm looking with a flashlight for the timer chain. I just skinned my knuckles and I'm in great pain. It's awful cold and it's starting to rain. 15 days under the hood.
Now, that's a tune that I was unfamiliar with and now is in my regular playlist because it's just a great moving tune.
One of the greatest cartoons out there. I can't believe Bruce Springsteen has never recorded it yet. But so a great cover that was sung by David Nelson right there. And the song 15 Days Under the Hood is written by Jack Temption,
yeah,
who many people will know wrote the song Peaceful Easy Feeling that the Eagles made famous.
Wow.
A lot of good songs from a lot of good people on this collection.
No doubt. Well, first of all, you know, when I was picking these clips, I was, because they're not as familiar to me and maybe not as much to my listeners, or maybe so, you know, I wanted to make sure that, you know, we got a little bit of the vocals, but the jamming is so good. I had to try and get as much of that jamming, and these guys really are cutting loose up there.
Yeah, it was, like I said, at this point in time, they were just, you know, they had another bass player change just not too many months before this gig. Steve Love joined the band. Skip Batten had left the band. Skip Batten had replaced Dave Torbert. Skip Batten played with the Birds. He was in the Riders from 1974 to 1976, or yeah, a little bit, or five. Did a couple of years, made two records with them. And then Steve Love joined the band, and he had previously played in Roger McGuinn's band, so another Birds tie-in. But also before that, Steve Love played with Rick Nelson in the Stone Canyon band and was playing bass, or I don't know if he plays bass or guitar on it, but he's on the hit song Garden Party. He's singing on that and plays on that.
I remember that song. That's funny.
Yeah, so it was great. So it seemed like every time the Riders would, you know, need somebody in their personnel changes as the years went on, they went to the Birds Farm Club. They went to the Birds, someone with Birds Association, because then when Spencer Dryden hung up the his drumming, which was not long after this show, like a year later, and started managing the band, they got Patrick Shanahan, who played with Steve Love in Rick Canyon's Stone Canyon Band. So there's another guy from it. And then they went for another guy when Steve Love left the band. They got Alan Kemp, who played bass and was also involved with the Stone Canyon Band. So
that's amazing. That's really funny.
It's funny how the Marin County, New Riders were poaching Los Angeles players at that point in time.
They knew where the good talent was, right?
Yeah, it was really good.
That's excellent. But I hope I'm not aging myself when I say one of the reasons why I picked this particular part of the song, and it really made me chuckle when I heard it the first time, is I'm old enough to know who Andy Granatelli is.
Same here.
You know, I remember with Mario Andretti and STP and all the STP commercials they used to have. That's great stuff.
The Racer's Edge.
That's right. Exactly right. And he worked it in very seamlessly, I thought, there. That was really good. Which album was this one on?
It's on the 19. It's called New Riders. It's their first one on MCA. It's got like the space asteroid with a New Riders logo on it on the cover. And yeah, that album was pretty much an album of covers and had one John Dawson song on it. So that's where a lot of these covers on this Hempstetter album.
Well, we have a lot more of this album to go and a lot more conversation with Rob Bleedstein to go, but I just want to pop in really quickly and do a quick little update on something very important and historic and possibly stupid in the world of marijuana. Dan?
Animal Red.
Yes, thank you. We're nothing if not consistent on the show, trying to always have a little fun on the lead, and why not go back to a fan favorite, which we'll come back to in a minute. But the Drug Enforcement Administration, otherwise known as the DEA, has made a historic decision, agreeing with the top federal health agency and proposing to move marijuana from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3 under the Controlled Substances Act, according to the Justice Department last week. Thank you to Marijuana Moment, by the way, for providing this good content on what's going on in the world of marijuana. We appreciate it. This decision comes more than 50 years after cannabis was first listed as a strictly prohibited drug on par with heroin and defined as a substance with no known medical value and a significant abuse potential, otherwise known as the dreaded Schedule 1. Moving marijuana to Schedule 3 is recommended by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and all sound-thinking human beings everywhere. Also carries major implications for state legal cannabis businesses if it's ultimately implemented. It will mean that marijuana firms can officially take federal tax deductions that they've been barred from under Internal Revenue Service Code 280E, right? So you can't take any normal business deductions under 280E. Which makes it very difficult for any dispensary to really operate at a profit. Also, 280E will go away. Banking services will come back. And I suppose another very important part of it is that we're going to be able to have both federal and academia start doing studies on cannabis so we can stop all the guessing, even though it seems that there's a pretty good body of research and study out there that we talk about regularly on this show. And the hope is that this everything that's going to go further with this now will come and move in to substantiate all of it. We'll see what happens. On the we've talked about this move before, and on the surface, it's a very appealing move, right? Because if you're a dispensary owner or a cultivator, or really just anybody wanting to do business with the cannabis industry, you can now get banking services. You no longer have to worry about a bank pulling its mortgage from out underneath you. Well, I shouldn't say that. Banks will do their own risk assessments, but at least not as a result of federal law. Will they say, oh, you're operating a marijuana business on your property, so I'm going to pull it and off we're going to go. They won't be able to do that. As we talked about, there's no longer any 280E restrictions, which is, that definitely a good thing. It's a good thing for anyone who's in a retail operation or delivery service or however you're doing it in all the various states that have these services. And you no longer have to You can make a profit, right? Let's just say it like that. You're going to be able to take normal business deductions, and that'll be great. And as we said, allowing for full medical research. But we've talked about the negatives of this, and it's important that we do not lose the negatives in this rush to try and take advantage of what is seen as a quote-unquote step in the right direction. And I've often argued that, you know, maybe it's just a step backwards. And why? Because after all of this shuffling and moving around and benefits and this and that, marijuana is still federally illegal. That means that state businesses are still operating in an environment where the feds say what you're doing is illegal. And even though they haven't shown a propensity lately to come sweeping into states and start rounding people up, if it's federally illegal, there's really nothing stopping them at any point in time, unless somebody's going to tell me they're going to put a clause in here and memorialize the terms of the Cole Amendment, which, by the way, Trump threw out his second year in office when Jeff Sessions made a big impassioned plea that kind of proved that he was never going to really do anything and wasn't somebody we had to worry about. But we're still looking at something, like I say, that is Schedule 3. It's illegal. That's not good. For me, that's very problematic because even if you tell banks, okay, look, you can go do business with these guys. Yes, you can do all of this. It's okay. When you're talking about something that is federally illegal, banks are always going to have cold feet, and they're going to take a safe rather than risky business approach to it. And it may very well be that we'll never be able to even get those banking services. 280E is very important, as long as the IRS doesn't try and get cute and switch it to say that any illegal drug sold at retail, which I wouldn't put past them, because why would they give up on a huge revenue stream? But here's the other problem, is it currently exists right now. All drugs that are on Schedules 1, 2, and 3 must be prescribed by a licensed healthcare provider, typically a doctor, although many times these days there's physician's assistants and other types of mental health care workers and people who have been given licenses and authority to be able to write prescriptions, but it would have to be somebody like that. Now, in Illinois, I can tell you that we've seen a lot of reluctance on the part of licensed physicians to even sign the document that says, yes, Larry Mishkin qualifies for this program because I can verify that he has this condition that is listed as one of the qualifying conditions. And a lot of doctors are very nervous and leery about signing that. I don't know how you're going to use it. What if you abuse it and somebody comes back and sues me? And, you know, not unreasonable points, even though I think we've gotten far enough along, at least to hope that, you know, people still aren't concerned that that's a big issue that we have to be worried about. But nonetheless, you know, to now tell your doctor, you're not just okaying me into the program, you're actually writing the prescription for me, or are they going to take the position, well, we're already violating federal law and everything else, so you don't really have to have a doctor write a prescription. We're still going to have adult use, and you're still going to be able to walk in off the street and buy it. Well, you know, that seems to me to be kind of a historic violation of something that's a Schedule 3 drug, and what's going to stop other retailers of Schedule 3 products from saying, why can't we do the same thing? The other problem is that drugs on Schedules 1, 2, and 3, at least currently, can only be dispensed by licensed pharmacists. I would say that very few, if any, dispensaries are owned or run by licensed pharmacists. Maybe there's a few out there. But if we're going to take this on and say, well, if we're going to be in compliance with the code here and you know, make sure that we're doing everything right, are we going to force dispensary owners to have to go out and sign deals with pharmacists to come in and be their official pharmacists, who will be the one, quote unquote, to be dispensing? And if so, how much are these pharmacists going to cost when all of a sudden they realize they're a necessary commodity in the midst of this entire transaction? You know, how is that going to work out? So the bottom line is, if we make it legal, we already get the benefits we're talking about, but we don't have to worry about the rest of this. And why they're not willing to just move it all the way to legal remains a big mystery, other than some of the really first-rate legislators that we've talked about who say, well, we don't think that the people know what marijuana really is when they say that they want it, trying to discount that it's now 60 to 70% approved by adults in this country. And we still have the wonderful senator from Kansas who remarked that she didn't want it legalized in her state because she just doesn't like the smell. So when we have these problems facing us, it's no wonder. Yes, I'm not going to be a total spoil sport about this. Any movement in the right direction is movement, as long as everybody doesn't now say, well, thank goodness this is over. We're Schedule 3. We're good to go. We need to keep pushing. It needs to be taken off of the schedules all together. And you know, hopefully that will happen sooner than later so that we can really have a chance to let this market take off and go in the directions that many people think that it's capable of going. And, you know, whether Congress will allow that to happen remains to be seen. You know, certainly the Biden administration has indicated its support for all of this, as they have to, because ultimately it is an administrative decision. And, you know, from Biden's perspective, I suppose it's not too bad to be able to take credit for that in a year where he's heading into an election that, you know, might be a lot closer than some people would like it to be. And any edge you can get in something like that would be a very good thing. And we're talking about a lot of young people right now, quite frankly, who may be souring on the Biden administration to the extent that they're participating in or supporting all of the college students who are currently locking themselves on campuses and protesting what's going on over in Israel and protesting the Biden administration for not taking a stronger ceasefire stance. You know, can legalizing marijuana help swing the momentum of these, you know, potential young voters, you know, back over his way? Who knows? But at this point, you got nothing to lose. It's going to be made legal by somebody. You might as well just go and do it all together and say, you know what? I slept on it last night. Screw Schedule 3. We're just making it legal and let's go forward. Nobody with a straight face can really sit there and explain why it should be on Schedule 1, because we've seen all the studies and we know the 50 years of study in Israel, all the years of study in this country. Guys like Paul Armentano and Steve Fox and guys like that who did all this wonderful research and put out books dispelling all of these myths and rumors that people still rely on when they go to their local community meetings to talk about why marijuana shouldn't be allowed in their community. And, you know, it's almost comical to watch their face when you have to say to them, no, actually, teenage smoking goes down in states where marijuana is made legal. And here's studies done by the industry. Here's studies done by the federal government. Here's six, you know, once a month, we're finding new studies that confirm this. People don't want to believe it. They laugh at reefer madness without admitting that they're really still living in it. So at any rate, we move on from marijuana. This is a big issue. We need to keep following it. Hopefully, at some point along the way, people will stop playing games and recognize that a substance out there that's less dangerous than alcohol, tobacco, nicotine, and some would even say caffeine should not be any more illegal than any of those are, which means they shouldn't be illegal. But we're making great strides, and that's a good thing. And Rob, I just have to turn to you and ask, you know, back when you were in high school taking busloads of kids to dead shows, did it ever occur to you that there might be a time when we'd be having a discussion about what level of illegality marijuana should even be?
Well, even years ago, I was, you know, the whole legalization thing, I never thought I'd see it in my lifetime. So it's all just sort of interesting. And the funny thing is, on this Hempstetter record, the version of Henry, the John Dawson tale of dope smuggling from Mexico, he talks about voting, you know, changing the laws. And he was one of the hugest proponents and cheerleaders of trying to get that going since, you know, 1970, whatever, when they were starting. So, yeah, and it's a really good dedication on that version of Henry on this one too. And I always think it's just a shame that he wasn't around when the legalization finally happened here in California, because I don't know if he'd certainly celebrate it. I don't know if he would actually believe it.
You know, so many people, it's hard to believe. I don't know if you had heard that just recently John Sinclair passed away up in the Ann Arbor area. Yeah. And of course, you know, he's a hero and a legend for getting arrested for what, possessing two joints or trying to sell them to what turned out to be an undercover officer, and they were prepared to basically lock him up forever. And the whole hash bash tradition up there formed around him, and he just passed away this year, just before the hash bash. You know, and it's a lot of these guys who fought the battle early on and really took it, you know, to the man, to the feds, to the local cops, to everywhere, to try and, you know, have this whole movement go forward. You know, the organizations like Normal and all of these that have been out there, you know, pounding the pavement and working on it for so long. And, you know, now here it is, it's happening. And I just laugh sometimes because we're arguing about whether it's legal enough and whether, you know, and you know, I mean, I guess if you're going to move to this stage, that's the next logical conversation to have. But the fact that on my way home tonight, there's, you know, five different places that I can pull into and buy joints if I want, you know, even if I don't, it's just still kind of a cool feeling to have.
Yeah. And it's just, it's a great feeling to just be able to know you can spark one up and not worry about anything.
Well, that's.
Got enough to worry about.
That's true, although, you know, at least in Illinois, there's some hot spots. Walking around downtown in the Loop smoking a joint is still a bit of a no-no. Not that anybody's going to necessarily arrest you, but they might stop you and hassle you for a minute. And, you know, if you're – well, of course, I guess if you're smoking a joint, you don't really care who's with you anyway. But, you know, you got to watch out for that stuff. You know, and God love, you know, the folks at TSA. They do their job very well. They make it very clear that they're there to look for explosives and nothing else. And I don't know, the thing that always cracks me up about that is we fly a lot on Midway Air, Southwest Airlines out of Midway in Chicago. And I've seen, these, amnesty boxes, right? Where like in Denver, all my son, I get to the airport, you dump it in the, at Midway Airport, they have the amnesty boxes on the other side of security. So you actually go through security, then you have the option of disposing of anything you want. And I'm thinking, man, you know, whether I meant to or not, if I already took that through security and they didn't take it from me.
Yeah.
But look, it's all fun.
I hear the hot job at Midway is actually the being the person who empties the amnesty box.
Oh, for so long. I've been dying to find out, you know, Denver's been doing it forever. Who has that concession?
Larry, you got to get that guy on your show. Come on.
If you know him and can help me find him, we'll do it. We'll stick Dan on him or something.
I think you just got to camp out at Midway one day right next to it and see who comes to it.
That's great. Yes. May have to do that. Wow. Very prescient of you to be talking about Henry, because that is the next clip that we have queued up. So let's go ahead and take a listen to this John Dawson tune.
About this time it all goes dry. Nothing round for love or money that'll get you high. Henry got pissed off and said he'd run to Mexico. See if he could come back holding 20 keys of gold. Now the road to Acapulco is very hard indeed. And it isn't any better if you haven't any weed. Henry's driving hard and straight on twisty mountain roads. Waiting back at home for Henry's load. Now he's rolling down the mountain, going fast, fast, fast. If he falls, if this one's gonna be his last. Then to Acapulco to turn the golden key. Henry, keep your brakes on for this corner if you please. Look out. Mexico, and he turned his truck around. He's talking with the man who hasn't grown from the ground. Henry tasted, he got wasted, couldn't even see. How he's going to drive like that is not the good. Daddy's rolling down the mountain, going fast, fast, fast. If he blows it, this one's gonna be his last. Then to Acapulco to turn the golden key. Henry, keep your brakes on for this corner if you please.
Wow, Rob, that is another great tune. The tempo on that is outstanding. The lyrics are hysterical. I have so many questions to ask you about it. I'm just going to begin where I feel like as a co-host of the Grateful Dead show here, I should, which is, this is Jerry on pedal steel on this one, isn't it?
No, that was Buddy Cage. You're playing from the Hempstetter album. It's Jerry. Jerry plays on the studio recording, the first album, New Riders of Purple Sage, self-titled first album.
Okay, well, that's my second strike of the day, but you know, I'm trying hard here. But yes,
hey, you got cannabis embedded in the show, so it's okay.
That's beautiful. that's actually really funny. And I'm assuming that when they're talking about 20 kilos of gold, they're talking about Acapulco gold.
Yeah, 20 keys. Yeah, considering this song, you know, he probably wrote it in 1960 something. But it's great. It is great to hear at this point, you know, to think that, you know, no one's really, well, I guess maybe some people are smuggling still a lot of Mexican weed, but living out here, you don't really see the need for it.
Oh, well, you know, according to a former president, you know, every immigrant that crosses the border is smuggling Acapulco gold, basically. Right. But
hey, the question is, where is the Acapulco gold? Because I remember way back then, those bags were gleaming yellow and it was truly gold. And you don't see that anymore. You don't see that
nowhere.
Forever.
Nowhere. We used to pick that up and it was a fan favorite up in Ann Arbor. Yeah. It was great stuff. I don't know where that is or what happened to it or why none of these dispensaries have picked up on it. But, you know, everybody's got their own ideas about what they want to do with that. So, you know.
Yeah. My latest line is people go, is it sativa? I'm like, if you want it to be.
It could be. So let me ask. So this is their... this is an earlier album. This song shows up on an earlier album of theirs, right?
First album.
Right. So, as I tried to say inartfully before, that's Garcia on pedal steel on the album. But this would have been an album that you were listening to, again, when you were like 9 or 10 years old?
I first got turned on to the band from their second album, Power Glide, when I was 10 years old.
Okay, now... At 10, you may have been hip enough to, you know, understand all of the lyrics. At 10, I'm not quite sure I was, or what I would have necessarily understood they were talking about.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. I was educated in the fourth grade to the soundtrack of Hair.
Hair.
And I learned more from this. I learned more from the soundtrack of Hair and seeing Hair on Broadway than a lot of things. And same way in the Woodstock album, too.
That's so funny.
Those are two very educational albums.
I suppose. I have the Woodstock album. And I'm sure I've listened to Hair somewhere along the way. But it was just slightly before my time. Not quite, but I wasn't like old enough to go to the theater at that point or see it or anything like that. But... Were your parents listening to this? I mean, like, were adults hearing this and saying,
no.
What the hell's going on?
I will never forget playing this tape of the Hempstetter Show. And there's a song on it. It's a cover of a Rusty Weir song. He's an Austin, Texas artist. And David Nelson sings it. It's called I Heard You Been Laying My Old Lady. And I will never forget being in like junior high school playing that song in my mom's car. And my mom was like, what the hell are you listening to? but never got anything about the, you know, the weed.
Well, see, that's good. I think
she smelled plenty of it. But.
I think I would have escaped it too. Cause I don't think my mom or dad would have come close to understanding any of it. You know, I like to tell the story that, you know, when I first saw, even though I saw The Dead over 100 times, I never saw them in St. Louis, where I'm from originally, until the very last tour, the third and fourth of the last shows ever.
Oh, you were at the riot.
Well, the night they had to keep the lights on because Jerry had gotten a death threat. So, you know, they kept the lights on all night. And, you know, I'm 35 years old. I'm married with kids. I have a law firm. I go to the show with my buddies, and I'm staying at my folks' house, and they drop me off, and I walk in, and my mom and dad are sitting up at the table waiting for me to come. So how was the show? The show was really good. Were people smoking marijuana? Yeah, people were smoking marijuana. It's a Grateful Dead show. Were you smoking marijuana? I was smoking marijuana. Well, you know, I don't like you when we smoke marijuana. I'm like, Dad, are we going to have this speech forever? You know, it was just...
Wow.
You know, that was my background. That's, you know, that was where I came to the table when it came to marijuana. So it took me a while to kind of catch up with everybody.
Well, glad you got to see them in your hometown, finally.
Right. Yeah. Well, yeah, I was supposed to see them there in, what year did he have the coma? 86. They were going to play at the Fox Theater in St. Louis in the summer. And a month before, he went into his diabetic coma, and they canceled all the shows.
I saw him at the Kiel in 1981.
Wow. The Kiel, yep. I saw concerts in the Kiel, but I never saw the Grateful Dead. I never saw them in St. Louis till there. But Kiel Opera House was a cool place to see shows. We enjoyed it. I mean, for us, it was. It was like all we knew.
Yeah, this was the auditorium.
Right, they have the auditorium and the concert venue the small stage.
I got to see these two Midwest ones. I was driving across the country and got to catch these two Midwest ones at Kansas City, like 2 days before it, and. I just, both those venues were cool. I thought the Kansas City Municipal Auditorium was a good room, and the Kiel was very cool too.
Well, they Kiel also has an opera house, but the only concert I remember playing there that mattered was in 78 when the Rolling Stones were on their Some Girls tour. And while they went from Minneapolis down to New Orleans, they decided to play an extra show and did it, you know, they announced it the day of in St. Louis, and they, you know, 3,500 people in the opera house. So, and I've got a funny story about that with my dad, but I don't want to take away from what we're talking about here today, because we got some other time. Well, maybe the next time I'm out in the Bay Area, we can go over to Andy and Alex's house and I'll tell you the story. But before you were talking about this Hempstetter album being available for download and on CD, but not vinyl, let me ask you, what is your listening pleasure if you have your choice among different types of ways to listen to music?
Well, I listen a lot in my car because it can be really loud.
Right, me too.
But these days I'm listening to a lot of high-res files just because it sounds great. And the easeability of being able to just access anything right out of a hard drive. But the LP collection never ceases to stop, even though I'm like, I need to stop buying these records. They're just like on the floor. There's nowhere to put them anymore. They're all on the floor. But it keeps growing. The stack on the floor just keeps getting further and further into the living room.
Now, just to be sure, when you say records, you mean vinyl?
Yeah. I like saying records because that's what they are. I don't know when they became vinyl, but I mean, I know what they're made of. But
well, when CDs showed up, right? We had, you know, had to have to distinguish.
Well, yeah, I guess CDs killed them, but the tides have turned where albums,
right? No, huge
vinyl now outsells CDs. So I'm waiting for the day when my 7 million CDs are suddenly worth something like LPs are now. Like, you go into some record store and you see some old record you have that you got for $5 forever and it's been sitting on your shelf forever and it's $94.
Right. You know? Yep. I was just there for record store day. I see that stuff. You know, it's like...
Record store day is great. I'm a big fan of it. We love making these writers records for it. Fans have definitely been responding to it.
Sure.
And it's just a great thing, you know, and hats off to all the indies still out there that, you know, it's great that they're doing okay now and they're still around and doing a little better than they were a couple of years ago, because it was a tough slog there for a long time.
Yep, I agree with that completely. I buy vinyl not as frequently as I used to. Part of the problem is I buy all the Dead CDs. When they get announced, I snap them up right away. Dave's Picks every year. I always get the box sets. And my wife yells at me because you can go on archive.org and download just about any one of the shows. But I'm one of those, I like all the packaging. I like all the detailed information.
And you may have every show and every tape, but it doesn't sound like it when they put it out. You know,
right, right.
And I don't know if you got the Dave's Picks 50 yet from the Palladium.
Oh yeah, I've been.
I don't know if you noticed the photos in there.
Are you in it?
I took every one of the photos in that package. Yeah.
Oh my God, I'm gonna go home tonight and look at it. That's amazing.
Yeah, I was like, I actually got it. I opened it up, and it's a great story behind it too. But I was like, I looked at it, I showed it to a friend. I go, not bad for a 15-year-old, right?
That's like you and Jay Blakesburg. He tells the story that he took his Insta camera to like English Town or something. I don't remember what his first show was.
I think the
Meadowlands. He took a bunch of pictures.
The Meadowlands the year after, yeah.
You know, that's great stuff. You know,
So there's an interesting story behind it. While I took slides, the photos that are in the Hempstetter package, I took that night from the front row. And I took them on slides, so I knew that for the package, I had to go find these slides and rescan them so they, you know, could look their best. So I knew that they were in a carousel that was in a box that was in my storage deep somewhere. So I'm in the process of finding that and getting that. I found another box of carousel slides, and I had no idea what it was. So I take them out and I start looking, and it's an entire, you know, probably 50 shots or something from the Palladium from May 4th, 1977, that I didn't even know I had. I mean, I knew I had scanned one or two of the good ones, really good ones, years ago, and it had that, but I was not even aware that I had these like 50 or so other shots sitting in this slide carousel. And it's great. It's great because some of them wound up being really cool and they're in that package.
No, that's wonderful. And you know, when I was first collecting tapes, those Palladium shows were like big shows to get. I loved them. In fact, last week we featured the show from the 30th, April 30th.
Yeah, that was
which
mine.
I love. At the end, it's got that St. Stephen not fade away Stella back into St. Stephen sandwich. That's just awesome.
And that Terrapin Encore to this day remains my favorite version of Terrapin I've ever
that's
seen.
That's a beautiful Terrapin too. That's right.
I'll never forget it. Mickey was breaking sticks left and right, and they were just flying up to like the not the ceiling, but pretty damn close. But yeah, those were some my earliest shows and. Look fondly wow. back on. Yeah, I look at my ticket stub and I remember we were literally in like the very last row the first night, and I'm like, wow, what were we thinking even going to that seat? We wouldn't do that now.
Well,
we wouldn't do that
because at that age, right? It's just being there is half the fun.
It was great. And then I realized, I'm like, okay, yeah, we started way at the back and end up on the rail eventually.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I'm just going to go totally off script here for a minute and ask you: are you planning to go see Dead & Co. at the Sphere?
Yes, I'll be there on May 17th
for the whole weekend of shows.
No, just that night. I'll be seeing Pearl Jam the night before at the MGM Grand.
Wow.
In Las Vegas, and then Dead & Company on the 17th. And I think I will also be seeing Dead & Company at the Sphere on June the 6th.
Okay. Any talk of Eddie Vedder walking over and jamming with the boys?
Haven't heard that one yet.
Okay. You would be the one to hear it, though, so.
I know that John Mayer's a fan.
Sure.
So that could happen.
Yeah. You know what? I'm excited that they're all coming back together. I'm trying to get out there on June 1st. Andy and Alex are going to be out there, a whole bunch of other people that weekend.
Cool. Well, I mean, I got to see a U2 show there, and it was just it's just reality altering. And then I'm sure, as you've seen, as a lot of people have seen the all the stuff from the Fish shows,
yep.
What they did was just... I mean, I wasn't there, but just looking at it, I'm like,
right.
Wow, they really knew how to do it. And I just look forward to the Dead thing so much because just, you got to assume with all the iconography and history and everything else, it's all got to be wrapped in there into some mind-blowing experience.
I'm waiting for them, like, you know, to bring up an image of Jerry playing guitar and the band playing along with him.
Yeah, I hope to see a lot of Jerry on there.
Very cool stuff all the way around. I feel a little bit old thinking about it, but on the other hand, you know, I figured, you know, they're gone. I didn't really think Dead & Company was gone because they always kind of left the door open that they might do something else. But, you know, it's like, boom, from retirement right back in. Sure.
It was that I think they were pretty clear. They said they just weren't touring.
Right. I don't disagree.
And you got to, you know, come on. I saw The Who's last show in 1982, didn't I?
I saw the Rolling Stones in 1981 in RFK Stadium on their Some Girls, not on the...
Right, but they weren't billing that as their farewell. I'm pretty sure in 1982, The Who were
right.
saying goodbye.
Yes, right, but even then, though, when the Stones walked on stage and we looked at them, and it's like, these guys are so old, man. They're done. Yeah. You know, that was, what, almost 40 years ago.
Hey, I got to tell you, last week I saw Neil Young and Crazy Horse, and Neil's 78 and killing it, and then you find out that his drummer, Ralph Molina, the legend, is 80 years old and killing it. And it was just like, yeah.
We talked about that last week. We have a whole group coming into Chicago right before Memorial Day weekend to see him out on Northerly Island. I don't know if you've ever been out to that venue.
Yeah.
It's a very cool venue, and he's going to be out there. So we have a whole group of us coming, and I think Andy and Alex will be there, other people, and it's going to be a good stuff.
Yeah, they're touring all across the country, so anybody you get a chance to see this Neil Young Crazy Horse thing, do not.
You know, the question is, are we going to get to catch the sets that he was playing out there? I mean, I could see like the first 8 songs and go home happy.
Yeah, it was so great, and the vibe was so great. You know, we walked out of that first night going, he could come back and play 15 completely different songs tomorrow. It just has that kind of vibe. And if he didn't and played the exact same show again, there'd be no complaints from here. I mean, his most recent song is from 1996. Right. It's incredible.
Right. That's what they were saying. I don't know. I, you know, during the pandemic, I was doing a lot of scanning around on YouTube, and I often came across the video. I don't remember who else was on stage with them but Trey and Neil Young doing one of those Down by the Rivers where they jammed it out for about 18, 19 minutes. And then I saw he did a 16-minute version of it again. And I'm like, that's what I want to see.
Yeah, and that was like the and that was the fourth song.
Right.
Well, and Cortez was a 15-minute opener.
Opener, right. Yeah. With a new verse.
Yeah.
That's just, wow. Well, obviously, there's lots of other stuff we could be talking about here, but I want to make sure we don't go too far astray. So let's dive back into the album just to keep things going. And we've got, Portland Woman, which we were just talking about. Let's hear it. This is a beautiful tune, and I have to read you the description that I found for it. It called a bittersweet love song progressing from touring boredom to be relieved by a casual hookup, with the payoff being the realization that the Portland woman who treats you right has actually made a deeper connection. I'm going back to my Portland woman. I don't want to be alone tonight.
Where'd you dig that up?
The internet, man. Where everything is.
And yeah, and just want to point out that, yeah, as we mentioned earlier, the jam in that song, and I don't know if you're able to pull a clip later on or and put a little piece in from that, but they get pretty out there, and it's pretty enthralling.
It's all just, you know, good stuff. And you know, I mean, they covered so many different genres, right? I mean, I like how in the middle of any one song, you can catch it's almost a little psychedelic, it's a little jammy, it's a little country, a little Americana. They just weave it all in.
Yeah, they were, you know, they were psychedelic cowboys from the start. You know, they put the spaciness and the psychedelia into the country rock thing kind of before anybody.
I have to say, I think it would have been pretty cool to see one of those mashups they did with the Dead when in the early 70s. And then I didn't realize, I saw that they may have did it with them again later in like 76 and 77.
They opened for them in a bunch in 74 in Oakland. And then it wasn't again until 1977 at English Town. And then New Year's Eve, 1977. And then closing Winterland.
Right. Okay. Did you ever see one of those shows with them opening for the Dead?
Yeah, I went to English Town. Yeah, that was just it. And I'm a humongous writer's freak, and you know, you're thinking like, oh my God, maybe Jerry's gonna sit in and blah 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 blah. So this is great. So I see him at English Town, and it's great when the writers announced that they were opening for the Dead on New Year's Eve, 1977. That was my ticket to seeing my first New Year's show, because I was like, I can't fucking miss this. I got, you know, I have to be there. I don't care if I'm 15, I'm 16. I gotta be there.
And you made it. That's awesome.
And I made it. So, but the thing about that night, and talking about the Garcia thing, you know, the fantasy of him sitting in with them, and I have a, you know, the video of that is on that Music Vault on YouTube. You can watch that whole New Riders show. And in the big, you can see, and I know I wasn't hallucinating. I remember that night. There are two pedal steels on the freaking stage. And I don't know if they were both buddies or why. You know, he never had two up there any other night. And I'm thinking it's going to happen. And I've been, and I'm, you know, I'm with this video on YouTube, I was able to find a spot and confirm it and take a screen grab. I'm like, there's two pedal steels right there. Like, I was tripping, but I wasn't hallucinating. It did happen.
Did Jerry walk out?
No, he didn't. That didn't happen. But there were two pedal steels. It could have happened, but it didn't happen.
They gave him the option.
I don't even know. Maybe Buddy just needed another steel that night, or he wanted to, or some roadie wanted to psych someone like me out.
Oh, that's that, too funny. That's really too funny.
Yeah, but and then they played with them again. They opened on New Year's Eve '81, I think that was the last time. Yeah,
that's amazing.
And they were at the closing Wonderland 2 the year after.
Right. That I have that album.
But they weren't on the broadcast.
No. Right. Right. That was also the one
with the Blues.
Was that Frankin and Davis?
No, that was Radio City. That was Radio City.
Right. Okay. Dan, do we have time for two more songs? Okay, good. Let's just jump into this next one that Rob picked that I probably would have picked too. And when you hear it, you'll know why, because we talk about it all the time. It goes to show you never can tell. So you never can tell Chuck Berry tune, and I love this one also. Well, composed while he was in prison for violating the Mann Act, as if violating the Mann Act is just
didn't
another.
Didn't know that one.
Yeah, you know, just another day in the life. Well, because when he wrote Promised Land also in prison, they made a big deal of saying he went to the prison library to check out the Atlas so he could plot his course across the country.
Wow.
Yeah. Chuck Berry's a St. Louis guy, so, you know.
I know that. As soon as you queued that up, I was like, that's why you played that one.
Sure. But this is a great tune, and I first kind of like fell in love with it again when I saw it in Pulp Fiction, which I thought, you know, it was wonderfully used there. But then, you know, as they started releasing all these Garcia albums, and it started popping up on a couple of them, and I was like, wow, I never knew Jerry played this. And I started listening to it, you know, over and over again at that point. And I like Chuck Berry's version of it from the movie, and just, I mean, his version in general. This version's a little more upbeat than that. Jerry, of course, stretches it out into about a 10-minute song like only he can do. But it's just a fun tune. Was this like a song that was a regular part of their repertoire?
It was another one of the cover songs that was on that New Riders album in 76. So they're, you know, in... But that year they played a lot, you know, for the next 2 or 3 years, you know, it became regular.
Right, because we talked about how they had Dead Flowers on there, and I love that tune too.
Yeah, Dead Flowers they started doing in like 1973. You Never Can Tell, they started doing it in 76 when that record came out.
And was it a coincidence that they were doing it while the Garcia band was doing it, or like were they all...
No, Garcia didn't start doing that till like the 90s.
Right, later, that's true.
Yeah,
that's true.
But anyway. And sort of made it into a shuffle almost. But one of the people who popularized that tune more than anybody is Emmylou Harris.
Right, right.
There's a version of hers that was highly popular for a long time.
That's true. Really quick question before we sign off that kind of, you know, relates to the interaction of all of this, because Grisman played a lot, I know, like with Garcia and probably with these guys from time to time, maybe Olden in the Way and other things that they all put together. And last week or 2 weeks ago now, I saw the Sam Grisman Project. Have you seen that?
Oh, yeah. Big fan. Great stuff.
I was kind of blown away by it. I was, you know, I mean, him, he was great. I just love anybody who knows how to play the bass. But then, you know, they tried out Kevin Cleveland on the fiddle. And
It's been a rotating cast of people. He plays with Rick Robertson and Dom Leslie and Aaron Lipp. And
Howard Levy, the harmonica player.
Chris. Oh, he sat in?
Yeah. I'm mixing up my shows. That was Bella Fleck and the Flecktones came to Skokie, Illinois, and played a show there, and out of nowhere, and he sat in on that. But
yeah, Sam's doing great stuff, and we were all involved just recently. I should let people know too. There's this great Jerry Garcia bluegrass exhibit that opened up at the Bluegrass Hall of Fame and Museum in Owensboro, Kentucky. So there's a exhibit there on Jerry Garcia's bluegrass years, including a lot of instruments, a lot of history. Right from his earliest days, before he was in the Warlocks or Grateful Dead, all the way up through the Garcia Grisman stuff, and it's really good.
Wow!
So anyone in that area should check it out. It's like an hour from Louisville, 2 hours from Nashville, and really a lot of care went into it, and it's going to be there for 2 years.
Unbelievable! Always good stuff to see.
So yeah, we had a great opening week. We had a great opening weekend there. Sam Grisman Project played. David Nelson was there. Eric Thompson was there. Leftover Salmon was the house band for two of the three nights. A lot of guys from Nashville came up. Ronnie McCurry and Jason Carter from Del McCurry Band. Kyle Tuttle from Molly Tuttle's band. Maria Moldauer was there. Peter Rowan was there. It was a great weekend.
Noam Pikelny's mother.
Love Noam.
Was my son's second grade teacher.
We love Noam.
And
what a talent.
We went in for a parent-teacher conference, and she said, I hear from talking to your son that you like the Grateful Dead. I said, I do. She goes, maybe you've heard of my son, Noam Pikelny. And I said, wait a second. I mean, now that I think about it, I guess it's kind of an uncommon last name, but I hadn't really put a Jewish day school in Chicago, the teacher, you know, tying her in with, you know, with Noam. But, yeah, we love him, too, listening to him. It's always a lot of fun. Very good stuff. Well, this is great, Rob, and I, you know, can't thank you enough for coming on the show. We could talk to you all day, but unfortunately, Dan shoots me those signals that says it's time to go home.
Yeah. All right. Great. Well, thank you. Appreciate it very much. Always fun visiting with you and chatting and talking weed and music. And
Hempstetter, where can we get it?
Anywhere. Oh no. Yeah. All your DSPs, those digital service providers, or you can pick up a CD, preferably at the store at nrps.net, and you can score some digital downloads there too. And look for the LP/vinyl later in the year.
That's awesome. We will be looking for it. We're going to go out on Glendale Train. What can you tell us about that number?
Talk about an Americana classic that John Dawson wrote in 1969 or whatever, but could easily have been written in 1869. It's got that kind of feel. And this is, again, a spectacular version where they're just on all cylinders. This was the show closer, and they tear it up. There you have it.
Okay. Well, let's enjoy it on our way out. Thank you again to Rob for joining us today. Please go out and buy Hempstetter. Come back next week, everyone. We have another great guest. We're going to be talking to Mark Caron, and it should be a lot of fun. So thank you all for being here. Have a great week. Enjoy your cannabis responsibly. See ya.
Now somebody robbed the Glendale train this morning at 9:30. Somebody robbed the Glendale train, and I swear I ain't lying. Now they made me off with 16 G's and left 2 boys lying cold. Somebody robbed the Glendale train, and they made off with the gold. Charlie Jones was the engineer. He had 20 years on the line. He kissed his wife at the station gate this morning at 6:35. Now everything went fine till 9:30 when Charlie looked up and he saw
There was men on horses, men with guns, and no signs of the law.
Yeah,
somebody robbed the Glendale train this morning, half past nine. Somebody robbed the Glendale train, and I swear I ain't lying. They made clean off with 16 G's and left two more lying cold. Somebody robbed the Glendale train and they made up with the gold.
Here's David.
Thanks for listening to today's show. To check out more great cannabis podcasts, go to podconnects.com. Here's a preview of one of our other shows.
Hey there, this is Cheryl Murray Powell Esquire, and I'm the host of the Terps in the City podcast. I'm a cannabis agricultural dietary supplement and trade attorney. I'm also a hemp farmer, and I've been recently named to the list of High Times Magazine's top 100 influencers in cannabis. I'm inviting you to follow me along my journey as I move back to New York to support the adult use market there. You're going to get a chance to listen to conversations with some of my friends along the way. I look forward to seeing you at Terps in the City.